Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce, the podcast series that explores the fascinating and often overlooked history of fresh fruits and vegetables. Here are your hosts, Patrick Kelly and John Carp.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Patrick, and welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce. We are in part three of our series titled The Stolen Lands of Hawaii. And the last time we chatted with you all, we were at a pretty intense moment in our story with two sides of the aisle here wanting different things. We had talked about the birth of the sugar plantations and the power that these people, led mostly by white American folks, that were desperate for increased wealth and trying to, you know, limit the rule of the monarchy. And then you had the other side of royalists that wanted to see the kingdom separate themselves increasingly from the sugar plantations. So today we're going to dive deeper into this story and see where we're all headed.
I agree, everyone. Welcome back. It is another fun time to visit Hawaii, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a little dark right now, but you know, it's still Hawaii, though.
Things are there. Listen, there's always a little darkness everywhere we go, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what keeps it interesting.
Well, I think too, with this four-part series, or this is the third part of it, is everybody's getting to understand that as Hawaii is this beautiful place, right? I mean, heck, did you know that on one of the islands is where they filmed Jurassic Park?
Oh, yeah.
And the second thing is, so I went to the Hawaiian Cultural Center with my wife back in 2000, I think it was like 12. As we're driving out there, they were like, hey, do you see those bunkers? So obviously when Pearl Harbor happened, there was military stationed out there and there was like bunkers in the hills.
Yeah.
Those were also used for scenes like Saving Private Ryan and other films that they filmed out there to use this luscious landscape and also some of the old military, I would say, bunkers and items that were there in the past. So I was able to go to this cultural center and it was literally like stepping into Maui's home. Like, you know what I mean? Or Moana, I should say.
Right,
like it was insane. It was awesome too. But to where it is today, there's a lot of history that is unpacked of what happened, right?
Yeah, no, obviously we've really started this whole series. If our listeners are only catching us now, we started with part one, really diving into the first contact Europeans made with the Hawaiians. Of course, we talked a little before European contact, but we're really starting to see how Hawaii looks and feels the way it feels today. And we're really in the middle of that story now. And by the end of today's episode, you're really going to understand why and how this island became part of the United States. So on that note, let's dive right into it. So like I said, we left off with this political tension really between the landowners and the royalists and natives of the islands. And as a result of that, there was something called the Committee of 13 that was established. And this committee initially was known as Committee of 9, and it was established in January 1883 and then became 13, just the number of people increased by 4. Nothing overly complicated with that. And essentially, this committee was established to seek the limitation of the king's powers and ultimately achieve annexation of Hawaii by the U.S. And you can imagine who was probably part of this group. It was mainly Hawaiian subjects, okay, but they were of American descent, and some of them even American citizens. You even had some German and British citizens in there. So these are not necessarily people looking for the best interest of the people of Hawaii. And one particular person that we're going to talk about, because again, this is the history of fresh produce, and we're doing this through the produce lens, is a man by the name of Sanford Dole. Now, let's give a little background about Sanford here. So Sanford is really the perfect person to talk about here because he really illustrates everything we've talked about up to this point. So as I go through his brief biography here, you're going to start to say, oh yeah, they mentioned this before in part two or part one. So he's a really good case study of where this is going. So Sanford was born in April 23rd, 1844 in Honolulu, and his father, Daniel Dole, arrived in Hawaii in 1841, and he was part of the American missionaries. So remember, we talked about this big wave of missionaries that first started coming to the islands in 1820. So Daniel Dole was the founder and first principal of the Punahou School, and Daniel had two boys. George was the elder and Sanford was the younger. Neither Sanford's father or mother had ever been naturalized as Hawaiian subjects. Because Sanford was born in Hawaii, he was a Hawaiian subject and never had to become a naturalized citizen of Hawaii in order to vote or to hold positions in the government of the kingdom. And that's key because he's going to play a key role in what's going to be coming. Sanford's mother died only 4 days after his birth. So he ended up actually being raised by Hawaiian nurses. So he really got immersed in the Hawaiian culture, the Hawaiian language. And Dole even said himself, "I am of American blood, but Hawaiian milk." So he's really experiencing the cultures of these two different places. In 1855, Dole's family moves to Koloa, Kauai, and his father becomes pastor of the congregation on that island or in that town and establishes a school there. And like most parents of that generation, he wanted Sanford to become a minister. Again, these are all missionaries. That was something they were very passionate and committed to. And Koloa was a very quiet place for Sanford to grow up. This was not in the hustle and bustle of Honolulu, the big city of the island. It was very quiet. And so because of that, Sanford's friends and playmates ended up being mostly natives. He learned all the traditional Hawaiian games and also became a very good Hawaiian diver. There was a type of Hawaiian form of diving, and he became very good at that. And Sanford, once he got age of college, he went to Massachusetts, studied there. And in 1868, he passed the Massachusetts bar exam and then practiced law briefly in Suffolk County of Boston and then returned to Honolulu as a lawyer. So didn't really follow his father's wishes, but lawyer, not a terrible second choice, I think. Once he came back to Hawaii, he lived pretty lively life in Honolulu. They went to many formal parties, kind of rubbing shoulders with the rich and the powerful, if you will, in that community. He ended up getting elected as president of the YMCA and the Hawaiian Missions Children's Society. And on top of all that, his law practice was continuing to grow. So this gives you a little bit of a background of Dole. And again, kind of this perfect example of all this collection of events that have happened on the islands since European contact has arrived. But going back to the committee that Dole's a part of. So Dole, again, he's not a plantation owner. He has no immediate direct connections to the sugar or the pineapple, but he is a lawyer. He is coming from a wealthy point of society. And so he was interested in establishing a government that was not ruled by a monarch and that had a little bit more liberal leaning. And he was a critical part of this group. And in 1887, the group formed a secret society along with itself called the Hawaiian League. And if you recall from our last part, I told you to remember this name, Lorne Thurston, who was also himself a grandson of American missionaries, drafted the group's constitution. So Lorne Thurston, if you remember, actually ended up absorbing or taking over the pineapple operation from Kidwell, which was the first cannery that was run. So he's in that picture too. So you got Sanford Dole, a lawyer coming back from this American background, and Lorne Thurston, who is also of missionary background, that's in this group. And this group, again, was looking primarily to secure the status and the power of these American missionary-based citizens, along with the sugar plantation owners and the pineapple owners. And this really all came to a head in 1887, when they pretty much had enough with King Kalakaua's rule and his practices and wanted to take things into their own hands. So Patrick, I'm going to pass the baton on to you and you can explain to us exactly what happened in 1887.
Listen, I like that you said you're going to pass the baton, but why don't you just pass me a bayonet and I'll tell you a little bit more. If you know,
I wanted to be a little gentle, you know, I don't want to be pointing bayonets at anybody.
I mean, you could point a bayonet at me. It's fine. I know where it's going. I know what you're planning on doing with it, but let's talk about, you know, the bayonet constitution. And that's going to be, I always say, a little bit fun because, you know, now we're looking at things. I've said we were having rules put in place, the constitution, the governments, people are getting involved. So in 1887, you know, people who were affiliated with pineapple and sugar plantations forced King Kalakaua to sign a new constitution. Now, Dole stated that the king appointed cabinet members. You know, I would say not for their ability to do the job, but for their ability to bend to his will. Gosh, that sounds so much like government still today. I'm not.
And not much has changed, has it?
Oh my gosh! Yeah, boom, boom. Right. So, you know, consequently, according to Dole, appropriated funds were shifted from one account to another. You know, for fantastic enterprises and for the personal aggrandizement of the royal family. So, U.S. Naval Base was established at Pearl Harbor as part of the new Hawaiian Constitution. We talked about that a little bit earlier, right? Mm-hmm. The Bayonet Constitution called that because the king had been forced to sign it at gunpoint. Does it make sense now, everybody? Why it was called the Bayonet Constitution? How crazy is that? Is that considered a constitution or is it considered blackmail at that point, John?
I don't know. I mean,
so confused.
Is that an overly clever name for a constitution? I mean, I wouldn't want to be promoting something called the Bayonet Constitution, but
I mean, I'm just saying. I mean, it doesn't seem like the fun thing to do, does it?
Sounds more like a gentler coup.
Very gentle, right?
Yeah, you know, no one's getting killed, but you know, it's
no one's getting killed, but still, just sign it.
Yeah.
But sign it, right? So I say as funny as that sounds, but I mean, that is why it was called the Bayonet Constitution. So as we looked at that, December 1887, the cabinet nominated Sanford Dole to become the justice of the Supreme Court, and the king reluctantly confirmed his appointment. Now, that's crazy, right? Now we've got Dole, again, like you said, not the Dole we know as today, but you got Sanford Dole, who's now on the Supreme Court. By 1891, Americans possessed four-fifths of the arable land in Hawaii, and the Hawaiian League wanted Hawaii to be part of the United States. I'm not sure why they wanted that, but I understand a little bit as we've been researching.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why they wanted to be there is as soon as you join the U.S., this territory, well, it's not a territory, it's a kingdom, joins the U.S., all the tariffs and taxes go away. So for sugar plantations and pineapple plantations, this is like instant profits. The 35, whatever percentage that they're throwing on their crop suddenly disappears. And for them, that's like easy business. I mean, if you consider overthrowing a government, easy business, but that's their ultimate goal. And what was also key with that Bayonet Constitution is basically it reduced the monarchy rule, right? So the king could appoint a cabinet, but place that cabinet under the sole authority of the legislator. And then any executive actions that the king wanted to make had to be approved by the cabinet. So you can see what's happening there. So yes, king, you can appoint whoever you want to the cabinet, but we're going to have to approve it through the legislature. So the legislature is essentially going to be the ones that say who's going to serve that cabinet. And then if the monarchy wants to take action, he has to have that approved by the cabinet, which again has been approved by the legislature. So the legislature is really seeking to drive the ship here. And if that wasn't enough, the new constitution also mandated that only people of certain ethnicities and who were rich enough could vote. So suddenly you disqualified a majority of poor native Hawaiians from voting. So that also plays into the hands of the rich white native population on the island. So you can see how this is all being set up for the benefit of, I guess we can call that in today's lingo, the top 1%, right?
That's pretty crazy. I mean, as we still see it to this day, top 1%, but then also we see a lot, right? See a lot of that, you know? So let's keep moving through. So the king sailed, you know, for California on November 25th, 1890. All right. So his sister appointed the regent in his absence. So she was in charge of the kingdom. She was reigning over it. Okay. Which is interesting too, right? In this time, appointing a woman of that nature to rule over the land. But we also got to remember that queens were very important back in the days. Just like they are now, they're still very important. I mean, we don't have many queens today besides Queen Elizabeth or the Queen of Ghana, you know, or things like that. But we got to remember that obviously the reign of the family stayed with who, right? When they were gone. Or as we said, you know, the heirs of the throne. So now, it was believed that it was to discuss, you know, McKinley Tariff and the Hawaiian ambassador to the U.S., which is why the king went over there. So his health was declining. It had been for a while. And he suffered a minor stroke in California. I mean, listen, if I went back to California, I might have a stroke too. I mean, after everything that's going on. But, you know, 2 days before his death, he lapsed into a coma and he died January 20th, 1891. So it's as crazy as it sounds, on November 25th, he set to take the journey. And within 2 months later, not even 2 months, he was pronounced dead. Death did not reach Hawaii, though, until January 29th, when his remains were returned to Honolulu.
Yeah, and that's, you can imagine the confusion and the panic on both sides of the aisle for the people of Hawaii. You know, you have the Committee of 13 and their entourage who are thinking, okay, well, this king that we kind of had in the palm of our hand has now died. What does that mean for our control?
We do.
And then for the natives, they've lost a king who tried to defend their interests. And again, same concern to them, who's going to come next and what does that mean for our future? So this is probably a great place to take a break. And when we return, we're going to find out who steps into King Kalakaua's shoes and where that path leads us. So we'll be right back.
JGLC, the place to be, a third-generation, family-owned and operated asset-based company. Throughout their 60 years in business, integrity, reliability, and loyalty to their customers has remained their top priority. JGLC guarantees 24/7 communication with your personal logistics coordinator. They offer competitive pricing without sacrificing services. They operate throughout the United States and Canada. JGLC's customers count on them for dependability and dedication carried out on every order, every time. 60 years of service for all your trucking needs. Visit them at jglc.com for your custom quote.
Farewell to thee, farewell to thee, the charming one who dwells in the shaded bowers. One fond embrace ere I depart until we meet again. And that, Patrick, were the lyrics of the chorus of Aloha O, which was a song written by the first, I believe, and last queen of Hawaii, Liliʻuokalani. And that song was actually written 20 years before the events we're going to describe, but seemed eerily appropriate for what befalls the island nation.
Hey, it was good, man. I thought we were going to a little, poems, and it's going to get a little dark there, you know.
I was going to, do a little tapping.
A little Edgar Allan Poe, yeah. Fun fact. Here's another fun fact. I'll say that for another history lesson. It doesn't go too much with this, but it goes through with poems. So I'm going to save it. You'll just have to wait till the next episode of the Hawaii episode.
If you needed a hook, there's your hook.
There you go. So I'm going to.
Poetry by Patrick.
A fun fact of a poet, something they were afraid of back in the, the early 1800s. So it's an old poet, but you hear it, you're going to be like, what? What? So, John, let's get back to talking though about this, because I'm telling you, as farewell to thee, everyone, farewell to thee.
Yes, it's starting to really unfold now. So we left off before the break with the, relatively unexpected sudden death of King Kalakaua, and we were asking who's going to fill the shoes. And the person that steps forward, which we kind of gave a hint in to the intro to the second part here, is Kalakaua's sister, who he left as regent to the kingdom when he was gone, and that was Liliʻuokalani. So she inherited the throne, and she was a pretty strong woman. She had absolutely no interest in the new constitution that her brother signed, and she had every inclination to propose a new one. And what her new constitution sought was to regain powers for the monarchy and the native Hawaiians that had been lost under the Bayonet Constitution. So she wasn't looking to necessarily go further than the constitution that was in place prior to the Bayonet Constitution. She just wanted to get back to where it was. And as you could probably imagine, this did not sit well with the business people and the Committee of 13. The fact that they have this new individual in place with these very strong desires to pretty much undo everything that they had just worked very hard to do wasn't going to get past them quietly. So basically sought to eliminate the Hawaiian royalty entirely. This was a step too far. There was no point in trying to renegotiate or do this in a long, drawn-out process as they had basically done previously. So a little background on Liliʻuokalani. So she was a typical princess of the royal family of Hawaii up to this point. She married an American. She had adopted several children. And as we heard at the beginning of this second part, she was a songwriter. And one of her songs, again, was that's Aloha O, and remains most well-known Hawaiian song today. And it was actually even in Lilo and Stitch, I recently learned. So
that's cool too.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song. So I definitely encourage our listeners to YouTube or Google or find that song and listen to it. It's a very pretty song. So what does the group of 13 or the Committee of 13 do? So on January 1893, Sanford Dole and the other sugar-based businessmen enlisted the help of the U.S. minister in Hawaii, who was John Stevens, to essentially assist them in a coup. Now, the businessmen, you know, it wasn't so much that they approached Stevens and said, hey, we're thinking about starting a coup. You want to help us out? No, they were a little more slick. They basically convinced Stevens that their lives, along with all the other Americans in Hawaii, were in danger with the threat of Liliuokalani's new constitution. They basically said, look, if this constitution goes into place, they're going to start to seek us out because they are accusing us of wanting to annex the government and overthrow her. We need your support in the form of military to ensure that we don't get killed or any other Americans get killed. So Stevens Law went along with this. There happened to be a U.S. cruiser by the name of Boston in the Honolulu port. And it was stationed there really just to have a presence because there were a lot of Americans on these islands. So it wasn't anything out of the norm, really. But as it was sitting there and these Committee of 13 basically said that our lives in danger, he unloaded 300 Marines from that cruiser. And with that, the Queen stepped down. In her eyes, she saw this as a threat from the U.S. military. And she knew right away, okay, you know, there's no way I'm going to fight against the U.S. military. That's just going to end in violence and bloodshed. Bad. Yeah, it's just not going to be good. It's not going to be a good situation. But in the midst of all this, the committee approaches Dole and says, look, we want you to step down as Supreme Court Justice and accept the role of president of this new provisional government that we want to put into place once the monarchy is overthrown. Dole accepts. And once Liliuokalani steps down from her throne, she's placed under immediate house arrest at the Iolani Palace in Honolulu, which ironically enough is where her brother had signed the Bayonet Constitution in 1887. And the organizers of the coup had justified their actions by saying that the queen was corrupt, she was anti-democratic, and all around not a good person for what they were trying to achieve. When Sanford and associates set up the Republic of Hawaii after removing her, she refused to swear her allegiance, rightfully so. And this led to her treason trial in 1895. You know, surprise, surprise, she was found guilty and sentenced to 5 years hard labor and fined $5,000. She never served the labor sentence, but she did remain under house arrest until she signed a document abdicating her throne. And she and her fellow prisoners were then pardoned further down the road. So now we're looking at February 1893. So remember, this all happens in January. So a month later, the U.S. minister in Hawaii, John Stevens, officially recognizes Dole's new government on his own authority. So this is not really a legal authority he has on behalf of the U.S. to recognize this, but he says it. And he proclaims Hawaii as a U.S. protectorate. And Dole accordingly then submits a treaty of annexation to the U.S. Senate. But most Democrats opposed it, especially after it came out that most Hawaiians didn't want this annexation. And then you have the current president of that time was Grover Cleveland, and he actually even sent a new U.S. minister to Hawaii to restore the queen to her throne under the 1887 Constitution. But Dole said, no, I'm not doing that. And instead, he says, you know what? If this is how you're going to be, we're going to establish our own independent Republic of Hawaii.
And there you have it. I mean, listen, there you literally have it. And
so you have your first president of Hawaii, your first and last.
And then it starts to get even better, right? I mean, there's a lot more to come, right? And part four is going to have a lot more. It's going to be the end of our four-part series. But, you know, my wife is a huge Hawaiian fan, as I've told you. And throughout the years, I've heard one Hawaiian song and one probably a very popular one. And, you know, if you don't know who Israel is, Kamakawiwo'olei is, you probably do, you just haven't heard it yet. So I went ahead and put this on, and this is all about the Hawaiian trip. To be fair, to somewhere over the rainbow, right, John? I mean, this is it right here. It speaks to Hawaii, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And it was crazy, this guy looks like that, right? I mean, the guy literally looks like that. Man, do you feel like you're getting in now to the new Hawaii versus all the crap that's happened over the last 100 years, John? Am I right? That's something that's crazy. So everyone, hey, kick it out. Let's kick it back and say goodbye.
Yes, thanks for listening, everybody. Remember to check our newsletter for more stories, because we can't capture everything in these episodes. So do remember to subscribe. We look forward to our next part and having you join us. Until next time, it's got bye from me, John Papp.
And Patrick Kelly, everyone. Ooh, 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 someday.